Hi there. Time for Spectrum West, everybody. I'm Al Ross. Good to have you along. Thanks to Jim Oliver and Dean Kallenbach for stepping in and putting on a great show last week, allowing me to take a necessary and momentary step back. Feels like I've been gone a long time. That's what happens when you enjoy hanging out with folks as much as I do you. Today, anyone who has a career as an NFL quarterback has a lot of good times to remember, but then life can dish out stuff that makes the low points seem much too low. Eric Hipple played for the Detroit Lions and in the CFL, but the story he wants you to hear has football only as a background. He's coming next week to the Forum Series at UW-Eau Claire and will share part of his story today. The Chippewa Valley Museum has a new director, Carrie Ronander. We'll make her acquaintance. Jim Oliver is here with the director of the Festival Theater season's first production, Fully Committed, opening next week in a temporary but notable venue as the historic Civic Auditorium that houses the festival in St. Croix Falls begins a facelift. And you know what? This is a good place to start. The Banbury Art Crawl opens its doors for the seventh time next Friday and Saturday. It's where nearly 100 artists gather and flocks of patrons, that's you. Maybe you didn't know that patrons come in flocks. Yes, they do. Anyway, you rally to see, touch, and appreciate works of those artists. Organizers and participants, artist Joe Ellen Burke and woodturner Gary Barone, called on me just the other day. Well, as you know, I usually treat people who have the guts to come in and do the interview specially. Okay. How do people become artists? I think we all, deep down, consider ourselves artists at some level. Unless you are, and maybe you, one of, or both of you are educated in art. So is the artist always burning inside, and then finally one has to just let it pop out or blossom? Or?
Well, in my case, I actually went to school as an undergrad and did get a degree in art. Actually, way back in that day, there was a stereotype of women going to college with a few options that were very limited, mm-hmm. teaching, nursing, and the arts. And it was somewhat restricted, whether it was self-imposed, I don't know. But mm-hmm. I had always gravitated toward art, and it was the field that I chose. And then really went into education and not art education necessarily. So I took a different path to teaching. Did my art on the side, and most of my art was watercolor and pen and ink. And because I had a love for architecture, I evolved to doing pen and ink drawings of homes for people. And then as I moved to Eau Claire, I did historic homes drawings.
I don't think I've ever seen any of those.
Well, if you go to Mogi's, they're on the wall.
Okay.
Nice to have your artwork on a wall in a bar.
Anytime someone suggests that I go to a tavern,
you're there.
I take them up on it.
Especially for fine art.
Twist my arm. I will try to go. Just for the art. Do you want anything to drink? No, just here for the art.
Just for the art.
So, Gary, you've been doing what you do for 17, 18 years, I read.
At least. Wood turning. The bowls has been an evolution of a lot of other stuff. I had high school art. I never got a degree in art. I started out, you know, probably doing the most simplest stuff, birdhouses and wall shelves back in the 80s. And I transformed into making full furniture. And then from there, I decided one day I was done turning spindles and stuff and just started turning bowls.
Well, so it's bowls for you now.
Yeah. There's a lot of ways you can do bowls.
Do you remember the first day that you were standing there saying, I need to make stuff to sell because this is a lot of fun?
I think it was more kind of I started making stuff and realized I had a lot of stuff and I was going to have to get rid of it.
Oh, well, that's, yeah.
What do I do with this? Mm-hmm. That was learning about the art show thing. Which I've always kind of stayed around the art shows. It's a good way to advertise, and it's a good way to get people to actually hold what you do. It came from one day I wanted to turn a bowl, and after I did the first one, I spent the next couple of days, that was all I thought about. And it was like, how could I do it? And I was drawing down plans and shapes. Because how I go about it, it's really a long process. I get the trees, they're storm-damaged trees. I don't buy wood.
Okay.
And so I'm actually drying the wood. From the drying stage, taking it to the completion stage. It's pretty time-consuming. So if a failed idea fails, it's months before I get to try it again.
Patience is a good virtue to have when you're involved in what you do.
Yeah. I mean, you can't put back together mistakes or errors. It's pretty much start over.
You know? Well, I'm glad you were here because that
scratches something off my list because I'm not a patient person. I won't be turning any bowls or drying my own wood. Many times artistic endeavor involves certain safety measures. Taking care of one's eyes and fingers and lungs, wood turning is probably one of the most prominent in that spotlight.
Oh, yeah. I wear safety glasses and a face shield.
Okay.
And I have a major dust collector. It pulls it right off of it as fast as it comes out, you know, and at the same time, I still wear a face respirator.
Good for you.
It's
because a lot of people don't.
Yeah, I've been to the doctor a lot of times for stuff in my eyes, even with all that, because there's just so much stuff flying around. But it's part of it. You just learn to be more careful. And I've managed to get to this point with all my digits and both eyes.
Let's talk about Banbury Place, because that's where the Banbury Art Crawl is. It's kind of evolved into a place where art is born and art has lived. It's like its own little neighborhood.
It is.
We keep talking about places around western Wisconsin where there are pockets of artists because they gravitated. It's kind of what's happened in
It is. It's Banbury. A real community. It's a culture of arts that are varied and evolving again. Some of the residents there have been there for 20 years. Some are moving in as we speak. So it's a vital, exciting place for people to develop their skills and to sell their artwork. It's just a thriving area with a real, I think there's just a real reverence for the history of Uniroyal. And that's always there. I think the generosity of Jack Kaiser with the properties that he has shared with us and allowed for us to conduct something like the crawl is always comes with respect for that history of the Uniroyal workers and what went on there. We often, probably once a week, will have somebody walk through who will say that either they had worked there years ago or their grandfather had worked there. And so there is there's a presence even within the old legend of ghosts being there. They're nice.
Good to say that. Yeah. Do they help out in the process?
Very positive. Yeah.
We're in the studio with Joellen Burke and Gary Barone. They are representing a lot of people involved in the 7th Banbury Art Crawl, which is next weekend, Friday, Saturday, February 5th and 6th, Buildings 13 and 10, Banbury Art Crawl. You would have thought that after this much time, people would have come to the realization that walking is easier than crawling. But these are artistic people, and they're quirky. So I can see why they would want to continue to crawl. What's new and exciting in the 7th?
Oh, boy. We have different foods every year. We have some music. We do have an additional probably 20 artists, so we'll have 30 in Building 10. And I should note that Building 10 to people can often look like Building 10-12 because of the way they label the buildings. So 10-12. And they will have some great food. This year we are doing something with Memorials Booster Club, and so they will provide food in Building 10. The artists and residents in Building 13 have reached, I think, about 62 or 63 participants, along with dancers and food up in Forage and music as well.
Kind of a magic deal. I like it a lot because it's just a totally different venue for an art gathering.
It is, and I think people that have not been there might be a little surprised at the rustic conditions.
Yeah.
Parking is available, but you do come in from an area that is a factory, and they get used to that.
When I was there last time, I pictured all the men and women with their lunchboxes going up and down the stairs and the anthill of activity that it must have been.
Absolutely. It's a real exciting place because there's so many people. We had up to 5,000 people go through last year. It's a meeting place, so you'll see people everywhere connecting as well as sharing their art.
Do artists say that Banbury is conducive to their creative process?
Oh, I think so. The studios themselves in Building 13 are very different in size and what goes on in each one. But anywhere from painters to potters to food preparation to antique stores. And Jack Kaiser, again, has just been so generous. People can really develop their own environment within their studios. So it's exciting to see what they've done with their spaces.
And it's a sturdy building.
Yes.
You can jump up and down and you don't have to worry about shaking the people, you know, below you. They might be painting. You know.
We have music going on in different studios all the time. So if you walk through on a Tuesday afternoon, you'll hear music coming from our great Glassworks folks that are playing some great 60s, and you'll hear dance music down the hall, and it's fun.
Do you have a huge area there, Gary?
I'm actually out of towner, so I'm in Building 10. My wife's a weaver. She does the one next to me, and we've been there, three or four years now.
So do you do your work there, or you just bring it in
to display it?
I see. Okay. You don't make noise there.
I think I probably would. I think it would be a good place to be as far as an artist. I really like the crawl because it's the time of the year, the middle of the winter. Mm-hmm. It's such a good time. It's big. You're not all shoulder to shoulder. We do some art shows where it's so confined.
Yeah.
And here it's so big and so open and it's so easy to get around. And there is a lot to see.
And people are wondering how they can wait for the Super Bowl.
But Al, they really should be worrying about Valentine's Day.
See, that's my problem. Worrying about you hit the nail on the head. Worrying about Valentine's Day.
That is really what.
That's why I don't do Valentine's Day anymore, because I worried about it too much.
Sure.
Because you think you're going to screw up.
Well, the worries stop when you see the abundance of available art to purchase for your loved one. So we do. Mm. We really stress the idea of supporting our regional artists, and that these are very hardworking people who work on the side or are retired or trying to make their living solely through their art. So we stress two things. They need support. So we hope people will purchase their art, and that it takes incredible courage, really, for people to put themselves out there and to share their work.
Website?
Yes, BanburyArtCrawl.org. There's a listing of the artists, where they will be. There's also a map. There's some great photos of all of their art.
Keep up the good work, and thanks for bringing us the art crawl every year.
Thank you.
Thank you, Al.
All the information you need to attend the 7th Banbury Art Crawl, and again, online at Banbury, that's B-A-N-B-U-R-Y, artcrawl.org. It's next Friday from 4 to 9 p.m. and Saturday from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. That's February 5th and 6th. You're listening to Spectrum West. Thanks for doing so. Coming up, Eric Hipple, pro quarterback, pays a visit, leaves an important message. A place specializing in old things wants you to know about something new. And Jim Oliver stops by next. Support for WPR comes from Luther College, where nearly 1,000 students, both music and non-music majors, participate in 6 choirs, 3 bands, and opera performances. More information at luther.edu. Support also comes from the UW Eau Claire Artists Series. The 20 dancers of the Milwaukee Ballet perform new works of classical and contemporary dance Tuesday, February 9th in Zorn Arena. Well, today Jim Oliver has a story about a challenging role for an actor and a venue that gets its first production.
The Festival Theater of St. Croix Falls will begin its theater series Friday, February the 5th, with the comedy Fully Committed. The show will run through February 21st at the Franklin Square Black Box. The director is Andrew Bradford Benson, Festival Theater's interim artistic director. He joins us by telephone. Your theatrical history includes your own one-man show. Andrew Bradford Benson is losing his mind while you were living in New York City. Are there similarities with the Fully Committed being a one-person play?
You know, it's similar in that it's a one-person play, but that's about where it ends, aside from the fact that it takes place in New York City. Mm-hmm. So my show was really about my experiences and a little bit of some comedy and some songs. This show is all about this one actor playing these 40 really diverse characters.
And who is this one actor?
This one actor is Chloe Armeo. She is a Twin Cities-based performer who will be spending her second bit of time with us at Festival Theater. She first joined us for our summer 2013 theater season, and now she is back.
Well, let's see now. Tell us a little bit about what this one-person play is about.
Well, yeah, like you mentioned, it's called Fully Committed by Becky Mode. And it is about Sam Pelizowski, who is a reservations agent at a 5-star New York City restaurant. So the play follows the course of a day in Sam's work at this restaurant as she deals with all of the various different people who call in and try and make reservations at such a fancy restaurant. So we follow Sam's story, and Chloe plays Sam, and she plays all of the other characters that call in to try and get a table.
Some of the reviews I read says that it has to do with trying to skewer the restaurant industry. In what way does it do that?
Well, I don't know if I agree it skewers the restaurant industry, but it certainly pokes fun at some of the stereotypes that you might see in a restaurant of that quality. So it's got a very funny kind of uppity maitre d' who is not very helpful to Sam trying to get the job done. It's got one of those kind of like all-star chefs with a bad attitude that you're kind of afraid to talk to as your boss. So it does have some of those things. But, you know, at the end of the day, I think it's a lot of really nice fun. And it might poke some fun at the restaurant industry, but I think it does so in good humor.
Uh-huh. A bit of a technical question here, I guess. Developing a character in a play is one thing, but how do you go about developing, as in the case of Fully Committed, 40 different characters?
Yeah, that's been one of the most fun parts of this rehearsal process with Chloe, because we spend most of our rehearsal time saying, okay, what does Bob's voice sound like? And how is that different from the chef? They're both kind of guys in the show that are mean. They're supposed to be a little frat-like, possibly. And so how do we make those characters distinct from each other? What are their postures like? And what is their two different relationships with Sam? So that's just one example. And so we spend all of our rehearsal time doing that kind of analysis on 40 different characters, coming up with 40 different voices and different perspectives on the world and different needs from this restaurant.
How about costuming? Are there changes in costumes during the show?
There aren't any changes in costume. Because it follows Sam and Sam's journey on this day, Chloe will just wear one costume, and then through switches in voice and posture, you'll understand that she's playing a new and different character, even though she'll look the same.
He is Andrew Bradford Benson, who is director of the Festival Theater in St. Croix Falls production of Fully Committed. And the other thing I was wondering about, how about a set? Is a set as a restaurant or is a place in the basement of the restaurant, or what is it?
Yeah, that's right. It is an office in the basement down in the bowels of this restaurant. So it's at the bottommost floor. It is a cramped, tiny little office space with a table and a couple phones and chairs and a lot of restaurant junk strewn about as it's been thrown in over the course of years of this restaurant being in business. So it's been really fun working with our set dresser to figure out what exactly that office is going to look like and all of the different ways we can make it look really realistic and make people believe that we are in the basement of a restaurant.
Well, the long-anticipated renovation of the Festival Theater's regular home is underway, or will be underway, I guess, this spring. And you're now performing in the Franklin Square Black Box. So how is that going so far?
It's been a really fun process. We are so excited that the city of St. Croix Falls is renovating the Civic Auditorium that we've called home since 1990. And so because we do need to be out of the theater space for the next year, we have built a black box theater in a downtown storefront in St. Croix Falls. And we have gotten to design it basically from the ground up, which has been really fun. And we're looking forward to presenting theater in ways that our audience hasn't seen before. You know, they haven't seen us do any kind of black box types of shows. So it's been a really great experience, and we're looking forward to debuting that new space with this production.
Okay, now you're going to have to explain to me, what is a black box?
So a black box is kind of exactly what it sounds like. It is a four-walled theater that is black from floor to ceiling. And the key to a black box theater is that it can be used in a lot of different ways and a lot of different floor plans. So as you have a typical proscenium style theater, which is what our home in the Civic Auditorium is, this really allows us to configure the space in different ways for each of the shows that we're doing. So some shows, the audience might come in, and they might be all sitting facing one direction like you would typically do at a theater show. And other shows that we're going to do this season, we might have the audience on three sides. We might have the audience on all four sides around the performance space. So that's kind of the customization that a black box theater allows us to explore.
Well, I hope I'm not giving something away here by asking how is it set up for Fully Committed?
Fully Committed will be a traditional setup with the audience all facing one direction to watch this show.
Uh-huh. The bill says that you are the interim artistic director.
Yeah, that is right. During this transition year for Festival Theater, I get to carry the torch of artistic leadership for this upcoming season. So I'm kind of the person that gets us from point A to point B through this transition. So we know that once we come back into the new theater space, it's going to be, you know, a very lovely new structure with multiple programming strands. And it's just my job to make sure that over this next year, we get to that place while also producing great theater.
You've been with the festival for quite a while, though, have you not?
Yes, I've worked for festival ever since the summer of 2012. That was my first season here.
Well, getting back to the black box for a minute, how many seats does it hold?
Right now, it's holding about 70 seats for our different productions. As we, you know, tweak the floor plan and change it up, that number may fluctuate slightly. But right now, we're holding pretty firm at 70 seats.
Mm-hmm. So what's coming up in the current season?
A lot of great things coming up this year that we're really excited about. In our main stage theater series, we have got Fully Committed. We will be following that up in April with The Grapes of Wrath, done in conjunction with The Big Read, which is a National Endowment for the Arts program. This summer, we will be doing three shows in ref. We're going to have Clue the Musical, Private Lives, and Steel Magnolias. And then this fall, we're going to round out the year with On Golden Pond during the October month. And then in Christmas, we're going to offer two different Christmas shows this year. We're going to do a Laura Ingalls Wilder Christmas, and we're going to do the Santaland Diaries, which is a one-person show that I will be performing in.
Ah, you just couldn't stay away, could you?
No, I can't.
Okay. Well, we've been visiting with Andrew Bradford Benson, who is the interim artistic director at the Festival Theater in St. Croix Falls and director of the theater's first offering of the season, Fully Committed. The show opens Friday, February 5th, and continues through Sunday the 7th. It will then play weekends through February 21st. For ticket information, you can go online to festivaltheater.org. And the theater is spelled R-E. Andrew Bradford Benson, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you so much. It was my pleasure.
And thank you, Mr. Oliver, as usual. This is Spectrum West. I'm Al Ross. Thanks for being with us today. I see that there's an open mic at the Cafe Wren in Luck, Wisconsin, and that is Friday evening, 7 to 9, and it says in parentheses, or so, that's how comfortable this is, says they'll prove that the warmth of community is more than a match for the frost of January. Performances begin about 7 o'clock or shortly thereafter at the Wren Cafe. That's in beautiful Luck, Wisconsin. Tonight, if you're listening Thursday, the 28th, there's an open house at Fierce Freedom and Thrive Rescue Homes, Hillcrest Parkway, Suite 100. That's a 2519 Hillcrest Parkway. Learn about anti-human trafficking opportunities for the coming year. Information at 715-514-2890. At the Northern Lake Center for the Arts in Amory, an exhibit of work by Walter Van Blarikum opens Friday, February 5th, featuring an opening event on the 5th, beginning at 7:30 p.m. That exhibit extends through March 5th. There right now, there's a student art exhibit from Amory Public Schools on display through the end of the month as well. Still to come, a professional football player shares his story. But first, the chair set aside for the director at the Chippewa Valley Museum has been a bit of a musical one for a little while, but now it appears it'll be occupied for someone for some time, someone who knows the territory well. Carrie Ronander was recently appointed director, that's the word, but she'll be coming to work at the same building she's been arriving at each day for years, the number in the teens. She was handed the reins of the respected institution on January 12th, and so it was high time that we got to know her better. Congratulations on the appointment.
Thank you very much.
You have degrees, bachelor's and master's in history. Did you know early that history had plans for you in the future?
I knew that I loved history. Yeah. I was one of those history geeks as a kid.
Okay.
Fell in love with Abraham Lincoln as a third grader. And then the question always becomes when you're in college, what to do with a history degree.
When did you have a focus that maybe museum work was it?
It was after I graduated. My husband and I had moved to the Twin Cities, and I had a degree in history and a broad field social science minor. Mm-hmm, so I was going to student teach and be a history teacher. Mm-hmm. But I moved to the Twin Cities and was a little apprehensive about teaching in the school system there. And poked around and thought, well, to use a history degree, I could maybe work in a museum. And kind of worked from there. I went and got a graduate degree in American history, but they also had a graduate minor in museum studies at the U of M campus. So that really opened some doors.
You must have always liked museums, being a history buff.
I did. I remember going to the Milwaukee Public Museum as a kid when I was young.
Oh, sure. Me too.
So we did explore museums.
Seeing all those dioramas was cool.
The Buffalo. I remember the Buffalo. Mm. An old town, Milwaukee, old city, Milwaukee streets.
Yes.
That was fascinating.
It was nice of parents to do that. Now, you have 15 years in as curator at the museum, same one you now lead. I'm not an expert on museum jobs, but it appears that curator's kind of perfect training for becoming a director because you do a lot of hands-on and handshaking over the years.
I do. I've had a lot of opportunities to meet a lot of different people in the community. What a curator does is really decide what kind of items belong in the museum's object collection. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so people will have come over the years and said, we have this item, whether it's a wedding dress or a rifle. And I talk with them about what they have and try to capture the story as much as anything else. Mm-hmm. And it's those stories that have been probably the highlight of my entire 15 years of at the museum. And what I love about the museum is just talking to people and finding out what makes them tick and what is important to them.
Yeah, I mean, if you're involved in putting together what a museum presents or displays, I can't think of better preparation for eventually directing the museum.
I was exposed to a lot of different aspects of the museum. Over the years, I began as a curator just working with the collections, and then I began to work more directly with the former director, Susan McLeod, on different kinds of programs. There was this huge project we did over the years working with teachers.
Yeah.
So I was out more in the community as well. So meeting different people and learning what kind of history they enjoy, that has really helped as well.
Let's expound on that because that was one of my questions. One of the experiences I read about for which you're noted is your work with teachers in education. Did you, in your tenure, expand the museum's presence or collaboration with educational entities?
We worked with teachers from throughout Western and Northern Wisconsin. It was part of a federal grant called Teaching American History Grants.
Okay.
And these were projects that we did in cooperation with the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire History Department and then the local CSAs. And we developed professional development experiences for teachers in social studies. They would take courses at UW-Eau Claire, and they would do hands-on applied history at the museum and learn different ways that they could apply their content in the classroom. We did these projects for 10 years with this funding. I'm sure I talked to 600-700 teachers over those 10 years. And in fact, I still am in contact with quite a few, ranging all the way from Pembine in northeastern Wisconsin down to Eau Claire and Duluth, all over.
Wow. We're in the studio with Carrie Ronander. She's the new director of the Chippewa Valley Museum. That, of course, is located in Carson Park in Eau Claire. Tell our listeners how a museum operates behind the scenes. How are programs and exhibits decided on and then implemented? Because these are things that really have to be ultimately appealing and have a pretty good shelf life, don't they?
They do. Our exhibits, our long-running exhibits, run from 15 to 20 years. They do have a long shelf life. We have a Farleth exhibit that opened in 2004, which seemed like yesterday, but it's already been open for 11 years. We work a lot with consultants. We bring in who have expertise in museum fields, history, in all kinds of different studies. So we talk with them about what would make good history help them make good scholarship. But then we also will talk with our audience, people who come and visit the museum, our members, and have discussions with them about what they would find interesting. In fact, we just have an initiative this spring where we're really going to search out and seek some of these questions that we have about what kind of things do people really want to see and hear and do at the museum. Because I think right now we don't know. We think we know. I know what I find interesting, but we want to know what other people find interesting so they keep coming through our doors.
Well, the museum experience, if you look at it nationwide, has really changed a lot. I mean, it's gone from just walking around and looking at dioramas like you and I were talking about to now a lot of hands-on stuff. Technology has made its way into museums.
It has, and people really want to have an experience when they go into the museum. Yeah. I read a study just last week about how science museums are really perceived as the most interesting museum. I think it has largely to do because they're hands-on. And so that's what we're trying to also include in our history museum is things that people do because you can learn by doing. In fact, that's one of the big premises we had in our teacher programs is learning by doing.
So by the time you have decided on moving forward on an exhibition or a program or a presentation, you've done enough due diligence that you feel pretty well satisfied that this is going to survive the longevity that is necessary.
That is the plan. That is the hope. I mean, our exhibits take a long time to develop because we do all of that in-house. Programs, not as much. But again, programs change all the time. And what was interesting 10 years ago may not have the same kind of appeal these days. And so part of what we're doing this spring is finding out what kind of programs that people still are interested in joining in.
Yeah. Continuing on the theme of what goes on within the guts of a museum, how long of a process is it on average putting an exhibition together? And how long does it take to put the exhibition itself physically together?
I would say an exhibit can take anywhere from 2 to 4 years to develop behind the scenes.
Okay.
Coming from the concept development idea into actually designing what it's going to look like into putting it into the space.
Wow.
And it really depends on the size of the exhibit. An 1,800 square foot exhibit, we could probably install. It would take 3 months get up the walls and to reproduce the photographs that you would need. Our most recent exhibit is 4,200 square feet. That took us a good year.
That's so the changing currents. Yeah.
Changing currents took us a good year to get it installed.
And once an exhibit is up that is of that size, do you tweak it as time goes on? Do you say, well, let's...
We do. We add some different...
Do you have sketches that you work from? How do you know where things are going?
We have an exhibit designer. She makes a CAD design, so she makes sketches.
Oh, okay.
And then she also makes a scale model, which is very cool.
Oh, wow.
It's a little foam core model that really shows how things...
That even takes a while.
It does. And for us visually challenged individuals, it's really useful.
Do museums and museum people concentrate only on the past, or are they watching what's going on today and imagine it being part of a depiction down the road?
I think we pay attention to very much what's going on in the present and how that might be interpreted in the future.
Okay, good.
So when we're collecting objects for our museum collections or research materials, we're looking to see what our future generation is going to be looking at. And so that's what we try to preserve.
How old does something have to be before it's considered museum material? Because most of it's pretty dang old.
Most of it is pretty dang old. But we have items in our collection that are maybe only 5 years old, 15 years old.
And the way things are going nowadays, things become obsolete so quickly that they can be perceived as museum material after 5 years.
Right, like floppy disks and old computers.
Sure.
We have Mac computers from the early 2000s in our collections. We have a Teletubby in our collection. One of the reasons we try to collect things now before they sit in an attic or a barn for 50 years is that they're going to be still in good condition before they come to us. But it's a trick trying to identify what's going to have lasting value and what is just a flash in the pan.
We've previously brought up Changing Currents, the big exhibit there now, among others. What's the shelf life of that? What do you expect?
We expect Changing Currents to be up for another 10 to 15 years. We do plan to rotate some material out of it and try to keep it fresh. and try to adapt some of the new technologies. Back.
See, now when people hear that, a big exhibit's going to be up another 10 to 15 years, they perceive museum people sitting around with their feet up doing their nails. And you know.
But there are lots of other exhibits still going on at the museum.
Sure.
There are four different exhibit spaces we have at the museum.
Yeah.
And so trying to keep those all in a rotation so we have something new coming online every two or three years.
So it is a busy place.
It is a busy place.
Always. Mm-hmm. Anything on the horizon you can let out of the bag, or are those things kept secret?
There are no big, large exhibit plans on the very short horizon. We are working on a panel exhibit of photographs of early Eau Claire that we will be installing later on in the spring, working with some UW Eau Claire students on that project. We hope to have another photo exhibit this fall. But what we're going to be doing this spring and this summer is trying to plan out an exhibit schedule so we can figure out what kind of things we're going to put in those different spaces.
Mm-hmm. So someone out there listening now is saying, you know, the Chippewa Valley Museum is someplace I should go more regularly. How can they become part of your network?
We have a Facebook page that we regularly put all different kinds of things about the Chippewa Valley. We have a website, cvmuseum.com, that people can visit. We have brochures for people who wander in. That's the beauty of being in Carson Park. People actually can just wander by our museum and figure out what's in there, and they can come on in.
Because a lot of families are consistently looking for things to do, things new to do. And interestingly enough, a museum can often, even if it's, and especially if it's in your midst, it can be that breath of fresh air for a lot of kids who are playing video games. The old can be new.
It can be. And so we do have programs that we are developing. We have a calendar found on our website, different events that are coming up.
Congratulations again on the appointment. We look forward to bigger and better things under your administration. And keep us in the loop, if you would, please.
Well, thank you very much.
Carrie Ronander, the new director of the impressive Chippewa Valley Museum. If this is one of those things that sits right in your own backyard and you have yet to visit, well, your first visit can be online at cvmuseum.com to get the hours and some background. Then pack up the family or the grandkids and make a morning or an afternoon of it. Just as I do, they'll remember their visits to the museum just as vividly, I predict, as all the bright, shiny, luminous things we put in front of them today. Listening to Spectrum West on Wisconsin Public Radio. And support for Wisconsin Public Radio comes from the Eau Claire Regional Arts Center, Herman's Hermits, starring Peter Noon, come to Eau Claire to perform their hits from the 60s at the State Theater Thursday, February 25th. Tickets are available at EauClaireArts.com. There's stuff going on. Theatrical venues around western Wisconsin, Jim Oliver has it all for you right now.
Thanks, Al. The Eau Claire Children's Theater will present Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs next Thursday through Sunday at the State Theater in Eau Claire. The Children's Theater will present the final performances of its annual Mystery Dinner Theater production, Luck Be a Murder, Friday and Saturday at the Oxford Theater in Eau Claire. Advance reservations are required. The Old Gem Theater in New Richmond will present The Three Little Pigs Saturday and Sunday, February 6th and 7th. The show will be available for student audiences through February 21st. A dinner theater production of Move Over, Miss Markham will be presented February 5th through the 7th and the 11th through the 14th by the Great River Road Theater of Prescott. The performances will be staged at the Ridgetop on Highway 10. On Sunday, the Wide Spot Performing Arts Center of Stockholm will present an evening of improv. The St. Croix Festival Theater will begin its theater series this year with the comedy Fully Committed, opening on Friday and running through February 21st at the Franklin Square Black Box Theater in the old Ben Franklin building on Main Street in St. Croix Falls. Radio Days 2 will run Friday through Sunday at the Phipps Center for the Arts in Hudson. This is Spectrum West. I'm Jim Oliver.
Well, the Forum Series is a tradition at UW Eau Claire. This is the 74th season. It's about enlightenment, conversation. Authorities and prominent individuals devoted to ideals and causes visit and talk about their attachments. Next Wednesday, February 3rd, from the stage at the Schofield Auditorium, Eric Hipple will communicate several vital messages and the dedication he feels to imparting them. Eric Hipple spoke with me on the phone from his Michigan home after a long road trip?
I was in Djibouti, Africa, and then Bahrain, and then returned down to Arkansas for a conference, and then got home yesterday, early morning.
Wow. It's a very personal story for Eric Hipple, the retired NFL quarterback, one that years ago affected his life on several levels and continues to do so every day, one that he feels obligated to share.
If you get to the core of what I'm trying to present, you know, which is about mental fitness, which has to do with, you know, what are the things that we can do to help us out, but it's also the other side of that fence then is what happens when things go wrong? What does it look like? And so you can talk about trauma, you can talk about brain illnesses, you can talk about, you know, stress and stress control and those things which, when they get in the way of us being able to function at 100%, maybe less, obviously. Mm-hmm. And so it's about depression. It's about those brain illnesses that go along with it. But, again, it's about life events, but it's also about who we are genetically. Some of us have predispositions and others don't. But nobody's immune. And unfortunately, if things don't go right, one of the end results of that can be suicide. And how do we save somebody from that, or how do we help somebody from that? So it's about trying to stay healthy. It's about, you know, when things aren't healthy, what they look like. And that's the picture. And what I really do is take my story and kind of plug it in. So depending on if it's going to be associated with, you know, alcohol use and substances, you know, for self-medication, that might be more of an emphasis on it. If it's going to be about pure suicide prevention, then we'll emphasize on that. And if it's about, you know, brain health and mental fitness, it applies to everybody, then I'll spend more time on that. But at the core is that, you know, I use my story to kind of get there.
You were selected in the fourth round of the 1980 NFL draft by the Lions. Good size for a quarterback. You played at Utah State, where you also received a business administration degree. Utah State is most notable to Wisconsin fans as being a periodic preseason opponent and for sending Gary Anderson east to be the Badgers coach, although he didn't hang around long. I'm guessing the great Rams defensive lineman turned actor Merlin Olsen also played there, since the stadium is named in his honor.
That's correct.
Now, it's also suitable for us to be talking football, since opponents in the 50th Super Bowl have now been selected and will be overwhelmed with Super Bowl stuff for the next couple of weeks. But Eric Hipple's story, though it continues to have football as a backdrop, took a sad detour a decade of years after he left the playing field. Eric, tell us what happened and how things became clear in terms of how to spend your football retirement after that.
Well, there's a couple steps along the way, and one of them was, you know, after being released by the Lions, you know, that transition's not an easy one, nor transitions for anybody easy, but this happened to be a particularly tough one. And yet, even though I started a business afterwards, and which was successful in that business, somewhere along the road, I just started not feeling right and not feeling good, and I would call it the beginnings of depression, which got more severe, and it ended with the culmination of a suicide attempt, though it was very, very impulsive, by jumping out of a car at 80 miles an hour.
Wow.
You know, but I didn't get treatment for that. I never talked to anybody about that. And what got me into this field and been passionate about it was I lost my son to suicide. And he was 15 years old, and something that's unimaginable by a parent's, you know, view of how could a 15-year-old get to this point. And yet he had every classic symptom that I had experienced. Hmm. And so as a result of that, after a year worth of not grieving very well and coming unglued, I finally sought help and reached out and ended up at a place called the University of Michigan Depression Center, which is one of many now, but was one of its kind at the time, and got the help that I needed. And more than anything, though, got the education that I needed. You know, I went to this little mini medical school to learn about what had happened and what it was and the brain chemistry and the symptoms and what we can do.
Was your son aware of your problem?
No. That's one thing about, you know, stigma stands in the way that you don't talk about it. You kind of let him, nobody knew about my jumping out of the car. It was, everybody thought, well, some weird thing happened to the door and I fell out. Not talked about as a suicide attempt. It wasn't discussed that way. It was, but this really weird thing happened to the car.
I don't know why I'm bringing this up, but I did in my reading and research found it noteworthy that your most productive professional season, in terms of touchdown passes at least, with the Lions, came the same year that your only son was born. I guess maybe you were in a good state at that time.
I was in a good state. I was feeling good. And that actually was a very wonderful time because everything was moving really smooth. You know, the career was going well and all this stuff going well. And it's it's amazing that you take that snapshot, and it's just a few years later when you know when you're done,
mm-hmm.
and then the things that lead to what they led to.
Now, we always hear people talk about how certain things can put everything in perspective. Yours is a story that gives that statement, I mean, a real genuine definition and interpretation. I'm trying to imagine how all the important things in your heart and your mind got reshuffled when your son took his life. Up until that time, it was Eric Hipple, pro quarterback, then former pro quarterback, then TV football analyst. And you were a dad. You have three daughters as well. So did the way you look at most things change after 2000?
Everything changed. Just life, it took me a long time to pull through the darkness after that happened and just not wanting to live anymore because it just everything changed. I mean, how could this happen? Trying to take that moment in time and go backwards is impossible to do, but that's the only thing you can think about.
Mm-hmm.
And so outlook was completely different. It wasn't until actually being able to find the meaning, the purpose behind, find the answers behind it that I started coming back out of it again instead of finding something to be passionate about, which was, saving lives and trying to get this message out there that nobody should have to go through this.
We're on the phone with Eric Hipple, former NFL quarterback, now spokesperson for A Tough Experience. He's speaking as part of the Forum Series at the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire. On Wednesday, February 3rd, it's at 7:30 p.m. in Schofield Auditorium on campus there. It's a book and the title of your presentation, Real Men Do Cry. Tell us about, if you can, in maybe a way that you haven't already, the changing role that depression has played in your life. Under control, the process, et cetera, et cetera?
Very much in control. In fact, my life today is much more meaningful than it was even when I was playing ball and I thought I had the world by the tail. Much more meaningful and committed. My family is together. We're tight. I mean, and just look at life a little bit differently. Life is actually enjoyable and it's fun. It does have ups and downs, but the pressure is certainly under control. It doesn't mean things don't happen. They do when they come around, but it's just the way that you deal with them is completely different than this falsehood of looking at things where everything is about, achievement, and there's nothing else, meaningful in life, and that's all there is. There is much more.
And you must feel at least somewhat positive that your son, Jeff, has a positive legacy in what you're doing.
Very much so, because when you lose somebody, first the pain is to the extent where it's really hard to live with it. Guilt was part of that as well. How could I let this happen? But through that grief process and through learning that what is the cause of this, what is the medical condition behind it, you learn kind of appreciate the person that he was, and I can learn to appreciate the person that I am, and move past it to where you actually move into this area of love and really respecting, what you have taken from it and be able to have done with it in a very meaningful way.
I'll bet that you get people coming back and saying, Eric, seeing you, talking to you, reading your book really turned things around for me, and when they come back with that, you probably apply some of that to Jeff.
Very much so. And it's kind of rewarding when somebody does it, not because they're speaking to me about, hey, well, you really changed my life. What it really is giving somebody an opportunity to say, hey, they're not alone.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I think that's the best thing we can do for someone is let them know that they're not alone. And loneliness is a terrible thing, especially when you feel isolated and feel alone. Even though you might not be, but that's how you feel.
Yeah.
And for somebody to reach a hand across that, that chasm and pull them forward, I felt like that's what Jeff has done, certainly for me, and because of him for hopefully hundreds of others and thousands of others.
Sure. It is true that depression touches most people's lives at some time or another, some more notably than others, as we've found. I was going to ask, what do you want people to know about that phenomenon, depression? But it sounds as if the basics are you're not alone, as you just said.
Very much so, and treatable. So you're not alone, and there is something that we can do about it. And I think the number one takeaway is that it's okay to be healthy.
Yeah.
That means if you're not feeling right, it's okay to advocate for yourself and say, I want answers for this. And so to move forward and not to get stuck and not to be pushed in a corner.
The Forum Series is noted for bringing veterans of life experience with important messages. Your hope for what people retain as they leave the auditorium next Wednesday? I mean, maybe we're reiterating here, but what do you want people to leave with?
I want people to leave with a sense of hope that if they themselves or somebody they know are suffering from depression, that there is answers, and that we should advocate for that and move forward. But there is hope. It's death is not a solution.
Yeah, and even people who may not ever have depression enter their lives personally or know it in any family members, what you're bringing to people is the fact that they might be able to identify it in someone else, maybe someone they don't even know, but you can still take action.
And that's part of what, you know, I talk about is how do we notice it in somebody else if we don't know? First of all, there's a little bit about getting, you know, the education, what to look for. But the other part of this, you know, how do you actually apply that?
Yeah.
You know, how do you use that? Because, you know, it's nice to have a piece of paper to walk around with, but actually, how do you make that application and identify others, especially your, you know, loved ones, which is important.
I don't want to take away from the presentation for people out there who may be planning on going. It, again, is Wednesday, February 3rd, 7:30, Schofield Hall, University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire. Thanks, Eric, for the courage to share your story and for your willingness to put yourself through it time and time again in an effort to inform others and hopefully avoid the detour that you had to endure. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much, and thank you for bringing this forward. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Eric Hippel, Real Men Do Cry, the book and the presentation. Tickets by phone at 715-836-INFO or toll-free at 800-949-UWEC. Online at uwec.ly/tickets. At the Service Center in the East Lobby of Davies Center. And if not sold out, you can get tickets at the door as well. Well, thanks to J.J. Wickland for fresh promotional expressions, to Debbie, who somehow makes my perspective of Brown vivid, to Dean Collenbach for leading the troops, and to you who find time to make Spectrum West part of your week. I want to remind you that Friday night it's the Chi High Jazz Jam at the Heidi Center in Chippewa Falls, 7 o'clock, the annual Big Band Dance. That's a fundraiser for the Chippewa Falls Music Association, so if you can make it there, do so. Next week, a book about the kind of summer love that most of us have probably experienced. Vicki Emerson has a new CD and is bringing it on home, and more, always more, of course, on Spectrum West. I'm Al Ross. Thanks. See you.